May it please the court. This case is about giving Missouri citizens a voice in challenging unconstitutionally enacted statutes. The threshold question for this court today is whether or not a criminally accused can challenge an unconstitutionally enacted statute through declaratory judgment here in Cole County, Missouri, or if they must only challenge unconstitutionally enacted statutes in their underlying criminal case, wherever it may be.
So we're only talking about the cases that come that somebody is charged with a statute that's within the statute of limitations for bringing an action to attack the title subject and all that stuff, which I think is the year after the passage or the enactment of the law.
That's correct, Judge.
So after that, it's a defense. Solely, Your only crack at the statute is if you're prosecuted after that period of time, then you have to bring it up as a defense. So what you're asking for here is another route to that, to essentially put your defense forward.
That's a great question, Judge. And I think that is exactly what we're doing in the sense that the statute 516-500, which deals with procedural defects in laws, says that your statute of limitations is that you have till the end of the next legislative session to challenge a procedural defect, which is what we're doing in this particular case. The issue is then related to that other statute says that for misdemeanors, they have a one-year statute of limitations to file the case. So we have a situation where, for example, with Plaintiff Price in this particular case, House Bill 1715 went into effect July 3rd, 2008. The end of the next legislative session was May 15th, 2009. Mr. Price was charged on September 11th. 2009.
Could he challenge it before he gets charged? I mean, you say, well, I'm a person who drinks a little and drives, but I have standing to challenge this law.
I think that was an issue that was raised by the Attorney General early in this declaratory judgment action with Plaintiff Price. And they said, Mr. Price, you don't have a ripe case yet because you don't have charges filed against you. So their argument there was declaratory relief is not the appropriate avenue. But unfortunately, we didn't have a pending criminal case to file a motion to strike the priors based upon the unconstitutionality of the statute.
But here, Price and Ms. Schaefer have already pled guilty. And so is there a live controversy here?
I do think that there is, Judge. And in preparing for the oral arguments today, we actually came across a case that I want to give the citation to the court for. It's 301 Southwest 3rd, 586. It's State Ex Rel Coster versus Jackson. And that case was about that exact issue. In that particular case, you had somebody who had already pled guilty and pled guilty under what was later determined in State v. Turner to be an unconstitutional statute. He had already served his sentence. He was out on parole and raised it through a habeas corpus petition. And in that particular case, the court decided that, yes, in fact, even though it was 5 years later after State v. Turner had been decided, through habeas corpus, the individual was still able to come back in and challenge what amounted to an unconstitutional sentence that was placed upon him. And the core issue there, and there was a lot of discussion in that case about another case, I believe it was Simmons. And the issue there was, well, hold on a minute. How can he do this? Okay, and the core issue was, well, he didn't know about it. The court hadn't ultimately decided State v. Turner yet. So how could he have done anything about it? Okay, and in this case, this court hasn't decided the issue yet.
Well, was that not moot because there were collateral consequences that would attach to him? Or what was the reason we found that he could attack it 5 years later?
Judge, I think that it did relate to
because here there aren't. It's not collateral consequences. It's whether it's a prior conviction, what he's convicted of, but it's the same number of convictions. It wouldn't have the same kind of collateral consequences. It's not like he wouldn't be convicted. If this were thrown out.
Well, in this particular case with Michelle Schaefer, who is one of the two who had already pled guilty, if in fact this court rules in our favor ultimately on the merits, and we go back to the old Turner error for the cases that can be used for enhancement, Michelle Schaefer is going to go from a C felony down to a misdemeanor. So in that case, the collateral consequences associated with a felony conviction, which is what she took,
well, the two who have already pleaded, wouldn't their convictions would not be affected, though.
I think that's what this particular case was dealing with, is whether or not they can go back in after they've already pled and attack that and be resentenced under the correct constitutional statute, which couldn't use
that
for enhancement.
Rule 24035, a post-conviction
And that was, I think, in that same case, it also talked about that. And that was an issue obviously raised by the state in that particular case, saying, well, hold on a minute, couldn't you raise all these issues in post-conviction relief? And the question that was answered in that case was that, well, no, because in that particular instance, it was 5 years later that State v. Turner was decided.
But here, they were quite aware of the suit and, in fact, parties to it at the time they pled guilty. So isn't that very different?
I think that you can make some distinction there, but I think that what remains the same is that it hasn't been decided yet. We don't know what's going to happen with it. And unfortunately, and one of the points I would like to make to the court along those lines is that for Michelle Schaefer, she was put in a tough situation there in St. Charles County, because we were well aware from the prosecutor's office that through their recommendation, if we set that case for a motions hearing, which a motion to strike would be a motions hearing, that recommendation on the table that in this case didn't involve any jail time was not on the table anymore.
But isn't that a strategic decision that she made, that she took advantage of that plea bargain rather than wait to see what her rights would be? And so that she got the benefit of the strategic decision to do that, and she should not be able to, if that decision didn't allow her to continue to appeal that issue and keep that as a live issue, she's lost her opportunity to raise it.
I understand what the court's saying about that, I do. And I understand that there are some distinctions between this case and the case that was decided, State ex rel Koster. I guess the court's ultimately going to have to decide whether those distinctions, as applied to this particular individual in this particular case, are distinctions that warrant a different decision than was reached in that particular case. I can understand the court saying it's a trial strategy kind of decision. Do we go to trial or not? My argument is that's a horrible position. Simply because the legislature enacted an unconstitutional law, Ms. Schaefer has to decide, do I go forward and get sentenced under a law that hasn't yet been declared unconstitutional and not risk 7 years in prison if I jury try my case and lose, or do I take this deal, become a convicted felon, and not get to challenge the law?
Can I ask you to clarify something we talked about earlier, which is I was going to ask you why declaratory judgment would be available, because one of the requirements has to be that there's no adequate remedy at law, and why couldn't that simply be raised in the course of a criminal case? And did I understand from your answer to Judge Wolf's question, maybe you could answer it again, are you saying you could not, or you're concerned that you could not raise this issue in the criminal case?
In some of these cases, I think you might be able to raise that. Okay. The ones that were filed in such a way that there was still time to do that. One of the live plaintiffs in this case, Cindy Brandt, her case was filed on May 11th, and the end of the end of the legislative session was May 15th. So effectively what happened there is the statute of limitations for Ms. Brandt in her criminal case was 4 days. We didn't even have an appearance yet on the docket for her. And
your
Mr. Price was the same situation.
Okay. So your concern is that the court might find under that statute you referred to earlier that if they didn't challenge this on the grounds of the title and so forth within 1 year, then they couldn't challenge it in their criminal case.
Right.
And so you failed this. Okay.
That's my contention. I think that's the difference in a substantive challenge like under the Fourth Amendment and a procedural defect challenge, because that substantive challenge on the Fourth Amendment is always available. They can challenge it all the way through to the end of their case until they've ended their case. That's a different situation here. And I understand there are going to be some people that don't get to challenge it at all. They're going to have to rely on other people that hopefully take this step and bring an attorney in and challenge this, because they're going to be charged. They're going to have their date of offense after the date that the procedural defect statute ends. Okay, I understand that. Not everybody's going to get to challenge this. What I'm concerned about is a situation where nobody gets to challenge this. Because by manipulating the date that you charge somebody on that 1 year statute of limitations on a misdemeanor, and arguably on a felony, it's a debatable issue maybe for DWIs, but it could be a 3 year statute of limitations on felony DWIs. So we're talking about a long statute of limitations that through manipulation by the state, so state of Missouri, they can create a situation where the statute is never challenged.
And
that's
what
I'm concerned about.
And is that the facts of this case?
That's the facts of this case for some of the plaintiffs. You know, we have to remember there are more than one plaintiff in this particular case. For Michelle Schaefer, no, that particular example and analysis I'm giving you is not the case. For Mr. Price, it was the case, and for Ms. Brandt, it was very close.
From an abatement perspective, is this a race to the courthouse issue, where if your clients would have brought the declaratory judgment after they had been arrested but prior to being charged, then they would have been the first to bring the action and would receive deference, whereas by waiting until they're charged, the criminal case then receives deference.
I don't think so. I don't think so because, first of all, I don't think abatement applies. And I think the example of this race to the courthouse idea with abatement proves it doesn't apply, because what the abatement doctrine says is the second subsequent case doesn't just get deference, or the first case doesn't get deference, the second case is dismissed. Okay? I wish that were the case in a criminal context, because Mr. Price was charged after he filed his declaratory judgment. So if this concept of abatement were to apply, shouldn't the state have dismissed his criminal case? Well, of course not. Okay, so I think this concept of abatement
doesn't
apply.
Well, the issue of constitutionality would have been litigated in the first case.
I'm sorry, Judge?
The issue of constitutionality would have been litigated in the first case. Doesn't mean the criminal charge couldn't apply.
I would agree with you on that, Judge, in the sense that I don't think that this is one of those things where you get to take two bites at the apple, if that's the question the court is asking, where you can raise the issue and the declaratory judgment in Polk County and also there.
For judicial efficiency, ought we not to have one suit in which this issue proceeds? Because the issue really would be in both, the declaratory judgment and in the criminal one. If you have the criminal action, you're supposed to bring all your defenses there. It ought to be brought there. And we don't want suits proceeding in two different venues at the same time.
I think the first issue there is that when you decide it here against the state of Missouri, you're deciding it for a whole bunch of potentially different people. So you're doing one litigation in one place over the same issue instead of litigating it in front of 20 or 30 different judges.
The effect would be the same, wouldn't it? If he won in the individual criminal case and the statute is declared unconstitutional, it's declared unconstitutional for everybody that wants to rely on that case.
You're correct, Judge. The effect of the law is the same, but the number of times that the state, either through the Attorney General's office or the prosecutor's office, would have to actually argue this and write briefs for it would be numerously multiplied. In this case, we have three plaintiffs, and we had a whole bunch of briefs, but they were all written by the Attorney General's office for that one brief. Whereas if we're challenging this in three different courts with three different prosecutors, each one of them is going to be writing a different brief, arguing it, and recreating the wheel. So from a judicial efficiency standpoint, it makes more sense to have this one case decided right here today in front of this court as opposed to in front of a whole bunch of different criminal courts with different judges. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Your Honors. Jeremiah Morgan on behalf of the Attorney General in this case. Declaratory judgment is not a matter of right, but subject to the discretion of the trial court. That is the controlling issue in this case, and that is whether there was an abuse of discretion for the trial court to deny declaratory relief when in this case it's unquestionable there was an appropriate alternative remedy available. Imagine the problems that would exist if, as a result, criminal defendants could leave their criminal cases and instead go and file declaratory judgment actions to challenge either claims or issues in those cases and then go back to the criminal court and assert those defenses. There is only one plaintiff practically remaining in this case. Two of them have resolved their criminal cases and one dismissed early on. One of those plaintiffs is a good example of the reasons why declaratory judgment should not be available. Price, one of the defendants, not chief, one of the defendants in a criminal action.
Relatively.
right. One of the defendants in the criminal action and a plaintiff in this case, in fact, was surprised that he was never charged with a prior as a prior offender. And so the issue would have never arisen in his case. Yet he came forward in the declaratory judgment action to say and allege I could be subject to a prior offender status. And so a decision by Judge Wilson in Cole County would have had no effect upon him whatsoever. The standard review is pretty clear that in a declaratory judgment action, the trial court is granted wide discretion in applying the Declaratory Judgment Act. And all that is required are good reasons. And Judge Wilson went through a host of good reasons why this case was not appropriate for declaratory judgment relief.
Is there a risk, though, that it could evade review under that? Because if a case didn't happen to, if no case actually went to trial and the issue was raised, a criminal case, during that first year, then the appellate court would never have a chance to reach it and people would have lost their opportunity to attack it.
Well, that same kind of rationale would apply for anyone who was charged after a year. I mean, there could be somebody who's charged after 2 years with the same crime, which if they had been charged or if they had committed the crime within that first year, they might have raised it. But, and that's also not the case here, because every single one of them was charged, or the only one that's left was charged before that 1 year was up. And in fact, their stipulation, this is, and I think this is important, they stipulated at the trial court, before the trial court, that, quote, that in their criminal cases they, quote, have argued or could argue as a defense that House Bill 1715 is unconstitutional. They all stipulated that they would have an opportunity to raise it. So I don't believe it's one that is capable of repetition yet evading review, because they would have. And the natural consequences of this 1 year, kind of an oddity of 1 year challenge period. It's not even 1 year. It's still the last week of the first. I don't remember the exact standard, but that's true of anyone. I mean, it would have been somebody who wasn't arrested and charged until June.
Right.
Of that
so
year.
Is it your position though, if nobody's charged and contests this in a criminal case, then it's forever constitutional for every criminal defendant? And then I'm going to give you one follow up. Maybe
okay.
Maybe you'll work them into the same responses. Is mootness set aside, does this statute violate the Constitution?
On your first question, I confess that I'm not well enough versed on the intricacies of that provision of the statutes to say whether or not my recollection, there was case law that said that you have until your first opportunity to raise it, but I don't know that for certain. There certainly could be equitable tolling principles that might be applied, but that, because of the facts of this case, is not at issue here. Everyone had the opportunity before that first year was up. On your second issue, we did not address the constitutionality, nor did the trial court, so it's not been really developed. This is not really the case. This should never go to the merits because of the economic reasons why not to do that. Having said that, the bill was a watercraft bill originally. The subject matter of it was a watercraft bill. Certainly watercraft involved driving while intoxicated, and therefore, as you could say, is reasonably related to that, driving while intoxicated a motor vehicle as opposed to a water vehicle.
Nice try.
You didn't like that one, Judge Wolf?
Is that your best argument?
That's probably my best argument.
Okay.
Thank you for asking.
Back to your point about declaratory judgment as discretionary, I was just looking at the rule on judgment discretionary 8707.
Yes.
It says the court may refuse to render or enter a declaratory judgment or decree where such judgment or decree, if rendered or entered, would not terminate the uncertainty or controversy giving rise to the proceeding. So that's the grant of, I mean, that's what you're talking about when you're talking about discretion, aren't you? Just that very narrow instance where the court says, well, I'm not going to grant a declaratory judgment here because that really doesn't end this controversy.
Right.
Is that what your reference was to being discretionary?
Yeah, that's the reference. As it's developed in case law, there's been a number of reasons why, one of which is cases have considered if there are alternative remedies available, even if it's a defense in that alternative, it is still appropriate to permit dismissal at declaratory judgment.
But we haven't come to a categorical rule that if you've got a defense, then you don't have a declaratory judgment.
Right. I agree. I agree. There's no and maybe this is the case for that because in the nature of abstention doctrines that are available in the federal court, there's not one. If I might digress just a bit.
We don't abstain from our own stuff.
We don't abstain from our own things. Yeah. Yeah. If I might digress a bit, there when this case was filed, it felt wrong because there were alternative remedies available. In fact, many of which these plaintiffs asserted this as a defense in their criminal action, as they stipulated to. But I searched in vain for a unifying theory that would say, if you have a pending criminal action, it is inappropriate to grant or to permit a declaratory judgment action. But I certainly think it's an easy argument to say it would be an abuse of discretion for a trial court to entertain a declaratory judgment action when you have a pending criminal action in which the issues or claims being raised in the declaratory judgment action are available and could be asserted in the criminal action. Otherwise, truly, we would have in almost every criminal action people, for the benefit of not maybe offending the judge in the criminal action, or to to get a quicker resolution, run to Cole County or wherever to get it,
or to take a deal that's essentially a probation deal instead of facing a criminal a prison sentence.
Right. Well,
You're sort of like you're kind of saying to the litigant, if you go away, we'll go away. I mean, it's kind of a truce.
In a sense, I mean, if otherwise, all criminal actions, they would seek to try to undermine or circumvent that, so they could reduce their the potential bargain, if you will, as you described. Well, I mean, in every criminal case, you're going to have those bargains that, well, is this constitutional? Can we get this evidence in or not? And that's really what this provision goes to, is whether or not there's evidence coming in of a prior conviction.
Think about this scenario then. Okay. What if there's a perception that a particular criminal statute is unconstitutional that the prosecutors like, and so the prosecutors as an organization suggest that during this 1 year period it would be wise for none of us to file this particular charge, so that nobody would ever challenge this case during a time frame from which it may be held unconstitutional? How do we deal with that question?
Well, I don't know how to deal with that exactly, other than to say that strategic decision really isn't supported by public policy in the prosecutors going forward with what their case is. But having said that, that rationale would be true of any provision.
Well, it's a little different, though, than whether when you're dealing with a case that, let's say, it's a gray area on search and seizure. It's a little bit different because we have some more equalization of bargaining power. In other words, you may have a good claim, you may not, let's strike a deal. That's a little different when you look at it at a one-on-one situation where we have people where nobody gets to make that decision for themselves, because the time frame is just put off past the statute of limitations where the constitutionality could be challenged.
Well, I certainly hope that the incentives are not there for prosecutors to follow that kind of procedure. I think we all hope that that's not the circumstance. The public policy in Missouri is strong in favor of repeat offenders receiving enhanced sentences and so forth, but that rationale could equally apply to really every statute that is passed that may have a problem with single subjects and so forth, that, you know, they could, as a strategic matter to avoid the challenge, wait to assert it past that first year. And I don't think that takes away from the alternative remedy and the discretion that a trial court should use. In order to get there, we'd have to say the trial court in this case abused its discretion. Mm-hmm. And there were a number of reasons, not the least of which was their stipulation that they had this available as a defense.
So absent criminal defendants, then, who has incentive to challenge this statute? Until you've been charged, who's the public version of the Solicitor General to grade the constitutionality of this particular provision to make sure that the legislature acts in accordance with its obligations?
I don't know who that would be. I mean, maybe public defenders might be the but I'm not sure that they I suppose that they could come forward with an action, challenge it within the first year. Public defenders could.
But they have to have a client.
They would have to have I agree, they'd have to have a client.
That's my question. Can you clarify, is there someone who would have the ability to file the declaratory judgment case? Could your plaintiffs have filed it prior to being charged? Or being arrested as Judge Preston?
I don't think they could before being charged.
There would be no existing controversy?
No. There would be no existing controversy.
And what if the person was an alcoholic and they had a couple of convictions already, and the third one's going to be the enhancement? Could they make an argument, I'm an alcoholic, I'm bound to drive again, I'm bound to be charged again.
I'm going to do this
and
again.
And I want to get this thing, I don't want the enhancement.
I don't think so. They do not have a sufficient interest that has arisen there to make a claim. I think potentially the public defenders might be one, even without a claim, potentially could bring an action challenging something in advance because of the there.
I guess because they have so many resources, they're probably just waiting for these cases.
Or what about the Association of Private Defense Lawyers
and
ACLU?
Potentially. Those that would not have an alternative remedy available to them. There could be. We could certainly argue about that, but there certainly could be folks that could bring this action. I know there's a close-knit bar of attorneys that challenges or mm-hmm. works on these issues.
Can you bring a case without a client?
Can you bring a case without a client? Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There's no challenge to the constitutionality of the statute of limitations.
No, there was no. There was no. You mean in terms of us saying you have exceeded the statute? No, we have not. We did not assert that. In the summary judgment, that they are beyond the statute of limitations.
No. To whether the legislature could properly impose a statute of limitations. The plaintiff don't challenge the constitutionality of the statute that imposes that time frame.
No, there's no challenge to that. As I began with, and I just reiterate, declaratory judgment is not a matter of right. It is of discretion. In order for this court to strike that decision down, Judge Wilson would have to have been found to have abused his discretion, as evidenced by his many reasons why it was inappropriate in this case, not the least of which all of the plaintiffs had as available, particularly all those that are left, had as this available remedy this defense. This court should affirm Judge Wilson's decision and hold that declaratory judgment was not appropriate in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Please, the court. There are a number of issues that were addressed during Mr. Morgan's speech that I'd like to respond to, and I think they're very important for the court in terms of how we're going to decide whether or not declaratory judgment is an appropriate tool for what we're asking the court to do. And I think the largest issue that keeps coming up is this question of avoiding review altogether. And Mr. Morgan's response to that was simply, the prosecutors don't have an incentive to do that. And I understood that to mean that they want to prosecute crimes. Well, unfortunately, in this particular kind of instance, they get to have their cake and eat it too, so to speak. Because they can wait, in a lot of cases, past the statute of limitations to challenge a procedural defect, but it's still before the statute of limitations to file a misdemeanor. And so they still get to file the charges, but they avoid the challenge to the constitutionality of the statute. The other scenario is, what weighs greater?
Well, it's still going to be challenged by the defense when the defendant has an able lawyer. That one you can make a deal with, but then you can go you can still keep charging the person who doesn't have a very good lawyer, doesn't know about the defense, right?
Right. Well, I think there's an issue of if we push the filing date past the statute of limitations to challenge a procedural defect, can you raise that in a criminal case? And I think there's a big issue there. I don't know that you can. I mean, the statute of limitations would apply to the criminal case as much as it would to any sort of civil action.
But you could use it as a shield versus a sword. I mean, you could use it, you could say it versus a striking down the statute, you use it as a shield as a defense versus aggressively doing with the statute.
In the sense that you would be able to challenge the use of that in a criminal case, I'm not so sure. I still think, maybe I'm misunderstanding the court's question on that, but I think that the issue is, can you raise that at all in any context, whether as a shield or as a defense? And I'm concerned
I used to do a lot of truth in lending cases, and the statute of limitations is 1 year if you wanted to pursue the case, but if they wanted to collect on the judgment, or if they wanted to collect on the debt, you could always use it in recoupment or in defense to challenge it. You always said it was a shield versus a sword.
And I don't know if that, I don't know, Judge, whether that would apply in this particular case. I really don't think that if they're past the statute of limitations,
another
you can
thing
raise
is
it at all.
The statute might escape, have the review. Judge Ronnie White, when he was here, was the city councilor. He said if he reviewed every statute that the Board of Aldermen passed for constitutionality, I mean, it's just like there's a lot of statutes out there. If they don't have a controversy at the moment, it's there.
I understand that. I guess my largest concern is when the state that's passing unconstitutional laws has the ability then through the prosecutorial network to prevent any challenge procedurally to any law. In the instance here, we would be talking, if that were the case, where they can push it past the statute of limitations and it never gets challenged, you'll never hear about this again on any case. Because if you can't use declaratory relief to challenge it before you're being charged, and you can't raise it past the statute of limitations, then nobody ever anywhere could raise a procedural
defect.
Aren't
those hypothetical concerns here, though? Because you did have criminal cases in which you could and didn't. Mr. Morgan says that you stipulated that you could and did raise this issue in your criminal case.
And I understand what he's saying on that. I think the point to be made there on Cindy Brand, I think that's the best example in this case, because she was filed just before that into the next legislative session. But it gave her a four-day statute of limitations to file that in a criminal case. And I just don't think that that makes any sense when you have a situation.
Did your stipulation limit you, though, or what did you stipulate?
I think that Mr. Morgan is correct, that we incorrectly stipulated the fact that we've raised that or could raise that in the criminal cases. As a matter of fact, in Ms. Brandt's case, this issue has not been raised, and due to that four-day limitation, we didn't raise it. So I think it creates an interesting issue, which is when you get up to that point where you know that the end of the next legislative session is coming, what do? If you know you've committed the act, you went out and drove drunk and you got arrested, but you haven't been charged yet, you anticipate you probably will be charged, what do if you want to challenge that law? Either you file declaratory relief or you don't challenge it at all, because in the criminal case, you've gone past your statute of limitations. So if it isn't ripe, you got a problem, but if you can't challenge it in the criminal case, you have a problem and your constitutional rights are never addressed.
Is the Price case the one that hasn't been resolved yet?
It's the Brandt case, Your Honor.
The Brandt case is the one that has yet to be resolved.
Yes, Your Honor.
But we often get criminal cases where there's constitutional challenges to the person getting an example of the municipal charges being counted for enhancement for in the DWI context, and municipal charges being charged as for enhancement when we said that they're not really the same as state charges. I mean, there's always constitutional challenges to criminal cases, which come over to us, so you can always challenge it criminally if you're a defendant in a lawsuit.
I think if it's viewed as a substantive challenge, like a Fourth Amendment type challenge, you're absolutely correct. The statute in this particular case is limiting specifically to a statute of limitations to this procedural issue, and if that's given any sort of deference, then you wouldn't be able to challenge it in the criminal case at all. Thank you,
Judge. Thank you very much. Case is taken under submission.